The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Monday, the 18th of February, 2019. On the podcast today, I have Peter Whale, Executive Director of Strategic Minerals, SML, ticker there, and Peter provides updates on their Lee Creek copper prospect and their Redmore Tin and Tungsten project. Also on the podcast, Hayden Locke, Chief Executive Officer of Emerson, EML, and Hayden talks about the dynamic fertilizer market and its potential drivers in the short to mid-term. Plus, Paul Griffiths, Chief Executive Officer of Predator Oil and Gas, PRD, and Paul discusses developments at their prospects in Trinidad, Morocco, and Ireland. And, as always, it's a Monday, so Malky, oil and gas sector specialist, talks about the following companies: Sound Energy, Gannell Energy, Rock Rose Energy, President Energy, a lot of energy there, Eco Atlantic Oil and Gas, iGas Energy, and Anglo-African Oil and Gas. Plus, as always, I have two lists for you, the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too. By the way, you can see these lists, top 10 versions of these lists, at voxmarkets.co.uk, where you'll see a bunch of other content as well about 80 Energy and Red Emperor and other stuff worth looking at, and Expediator, all that stuff. Good results from those days. XPD meets targets with 54% revenue growth. That's all available. And obviously video interviews there as well at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Want to keep up to date with all the companies in your portfolio? On the free Vox Markets app, you can create multiple watch lists and get instant news alerts about any company you follow. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Peter Whale, Executive Director at Strategic Minerals. SML is the ticker there. Peter, thanks for joining me.
Hi, Justin. Good day.
Yeah, well, it's a good day for you, and some good news out. And you did have good news last week as well. So we'll catch up on two bits of news. One is from the tin tungsten mine in Redmore. One's at Lee Creek Copper and the drilling campaign there. Some good grades out there. We'll go into the detail of that. Before we do, as always, you've got more to the business than that. So just a quick summary, if you could, Peter. What's Strategic all about, please?
Sure. It's getting ever harder to do just a quick summary because we've got a lot going on and we're pretty busy. But ultimately, Strategic Minerals, SML, is profitable and diversified across various stages of operations, across different developed jurisdictions. We have a profitable producing asset in New Mexico. We're looking to restart a copper mine in South Australia. We've got a development project in Cornwall for tin and tungsten, and a pure exploration play in Western Australia where nickel, cobalt and rare earths are the target.
Yeah, so you're covering a lot, really. That's just, it's very exciting on many fronts. So let's go into this news. So you've got assay results from Lee Creek Copper Mine there. Tell us about some of these results and what you discovered there.
Sure. So to sort of step back to the big picture at Lee Creek, because I think perhaps not everybody understands what we've bought there and what we're doing, but the Mountain of Light is actually where the existing old heaps are and the processing equipment. Within a kilometre of there, we've got Paltridge North, and also adjacent to the Mountain of Light is the Rosamond East pit, which used to add material into the processing facility. We've also got Linda and Lorna Doone, which are much further away. There's JORC resources on Paltridge North, Linda and Lorna Doone. They're all broadly similar in terms of the contained metal for the copper. And what we ultimately are doing is producing copper cement, which goes into an offtake, which we have. So the big thing that's going on at the moment, we've been very deliberate and very measured about de-risking the whole restart of this operation. And that's partly tied into what today's news is and some of the recent news flow. So this was infill drilling at Paltridge North. And it showed some really decent intersections, good lengths, like 25 metres at over 1% copper, some concentrated sections at 2 to 3% copper. There was even actually 1 metre at 8.7% copper. So clearly, we're in the right place. We've come up with some results that are really solid. If you compare the existing JORC indicated resource for Paltridge North. That comes out with a grade of 0.82% copper. So this is a really solid endorsement that Paltridge North is not only valid, but perhaps even conservative in terms of what we have there. So, you know, don't forget, this is infill drilling. So it is about increasing confidence rather than necessarily upgrading the resource. But it's really encouraging to see higher grade areas, especially if it's at shallow depths. So really easy to see the prospectivity, even for a non-geo like myself. I mean, when we visited the site last year, it was pretty clear that we had something that was highly prospective. But it's good to get some actual solid results out. The team in Lee Creek is working on an updated resource model, which we expect to complete next month. Second part of the release today was covering Rosmond East. So that's adjacent to the Mountain of Light processing facility. It was previously mined down to the water table. There's water sitting at the bottom of this pit. You've got significant copper oxide mineralization that we've looked at, and we have data from previous drilling and our drilling as well. We did a couple of reverse circulation holes testing last year. This is further drilling to map out testing below the existing pit floor, and there's just the first results so far today. That actually shows that mineralization extends at least 60 meters below the current pit floor, and approximately 30 meters below the previously deepest known mineralization. So this should add great support as well. We've got more results to come from this, and they've actually been in areas where we know there's been higher grades, so we'll release those once we have them. So all in all, it's just reinforcing the fact that Lee Creek, we knew we had a bargain, but we're starting to demonstrate this now. I mean, there are diagrams of where we're drilling that I'm seeing in terms of how this translates into the extra resource potential that's below the existing pits, which perhaps some people wouldn't have even bothered investigating. But we're making sure no stone's unturned, because we really want to maximise what we've got. We are taking this very measured, risk-averse approach to restarting to production. We don't want to make any errors. We don't want to waste resources either. We're not just doing this for fun. We're doing this because it's the right thing to do. We've got an extensive team. We've got a lot of historical knowledge. And you know, we're very confident that there's going to be uplifts to mine life, even with increased production levels ultimately. So it's really looking really good. We're looking forward to restarting the operations in the first half of this year.
Yeah, that is exciting. And let's be honest, copper, you know, it's one of the favoured commodities, isn't it? There's no way to see how, you know, demand will not go up for copper in the next 5-10 years.
Yeah, copper is, you know, it's often a favourite commodity at the moment that's talked about. There are many projects out there that have involvement with copper. And as I said, we're producing ultimately copper cement, but critically our offtake with our offtake partner is 85% of LME copper price. So we're completely linked to copper metal, although we're producing copper cement. There was actually, it literally came out over the weekend, there was a report from Capital Economics, who I think are quite respected. I've attended a few of their seminars. They're talking about copper rising 60% in the next 6 years. So that would take it to about $10,000. They're suggesting that could be an overshoot due to constrained supply, demand from electric vehicles, etc. Often, some of these longer-term forecasts, and I call 6 years long-term at the moment, they can be conservative. So let's see. Copper is often a big risk proxy, the whole Dr. Copper scenario. China's the key to the puzzle as well, so we'll see. But that forecast alone is about three times higher than any consensus in estimates out there. So it's a pretty bullish outlier,
yeah.
But bodes very well.
Yeah. Well, let's move over to Redmore, closer to home here. So you've had a 200% increase in joke resource there, 137,000 tonnes of contained metal. That's looking good there too, isn't it?
It's looking fantastic. Again, to give a bit of history, when Strategic vended into this project two or three years ago now, there was an inferred mineral resource, which was 13.3 million tonnes at a grade of 0.56% tin equivalent. And that included 2.3 million tonnes at 1.19%. So that was the high-grade zone. And at that time, we said we had an additional high-grade exploration target, perhaps two to three times of the high grade, so 2 to 3 times 2.3 million at similar expected grades. Mm-hmm. Well, currently we've delivered 11.7 million at 1.17%. Included within that is 10.2 at 1.26%. So we've actually achieved 5 times the high grade. So having said we perhaps thought there was 2 to 3 times, we've achieved 5 times in the journey along this project so far. So I really don't think anybody can complain about that. The really all of the parameters and statistics that you can look at on this all point in the right direction. There's nothing really that sits as, well, that bit isn't as good, or that's a problem. You know, our guys in putting the block model together with our competent person, you know, the confidence level is extremely high. Also, our competent person, Paul Gribble, has extensive experience with Cornish geology as well. So that further underwrites the calibre of these results that he's comfortable with them. So it really does look good. And, you know, there's plenty more as well. There's the resource is open at depth over much of the length. It's also open to the west. None of that's factored in any of this. So really, really significant milestone. And I think, as I was saying to you before we started recording, there's a lot more attention on Redmore, and we've definitely had a few people who perhaps haven't realised there was even a project like this down in Cornwall. People are very familiar with South Crofty and the history there, but I think Redmore is picking up a little bit, so shall we say.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's the next there?
Okay, well, at the moment, we have some ongoing met test work, and we're looking to undertake a mining study, which is going to commence shortly. That's really going to identify what the development path is for the project, and ultimately that will be PFS, BFS, etc. You know, we're in discussions with NAE, our joint venture partner, on what steps to take. We also set in the release last week a new exploration target. That's a further 4 to 8 million tonnes at between 1 and 1.4% in equivalent. So that's, again, add on further down the line. We've got, you know, the situation with Wolf probably hasn't got much coverage recently. There's nothing that's happened for a fact at the moment. Don't forget that Wolf accounts for about 4% of global tungsten, and that's all offline at the moment. It may not sound like much, but tungsten's a pretty tight market. And whilst there are some new projects out there, tungsten's been flatlining. It's not exchange traded, and I think that's due for a move. We've already seen tin picking up. They do sometimes move in tandem. The other thing to mention really is that Redmore, the way it ranks now, it's actually the largest undeveloped tin or tungsten underground mining project in the world, probably excluding just a few very low-grade open pit operations. So if that's not worth people perhaps taking a look at Redmore and revisiting whether it has the potential to become a mine, then I don't know what it is really.
Yeah, say that again. It's the largest undeveloped... Say again, sorry.
Okay, so it's the largest undeveloped tin or tungsten underground mining project in the world. This is based on a contained metal basis. So the contained metal on the resource upgrade last week is ranking it accordingly. We've had a tweet out with a graph of that those comparisons that went out last week.
Wow, that's quite a claim there. Marvellous stuff. Well, Pete, it seems to be going very well at Strategic, and if someone's listening to this right now, it likes exactly what you're doing, but are not following the story, give them three quick reasons in summary why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please.
Okay. It's hard to give a top reason, so I'm going to do a joint top reason for number one and number two. Purely alphabetically, Lee Creek is a key period. There's some significant critical mass coming. I think maybe people didn't even read the RNS clearly today to see the sort of grades that were coming out with versus the JORC, and the fact there was an 8.7% intersection in there. I mean, that's a headline grabber. Mm-hmm. Secondly, Redmore. Credibility is starting to happen there. Perhaps people dismissed Redmore as, well, people have drilled in Cornwall again and nothing happened. Things are happening, and you know, we are looking to move forward. It's very much a case of when or if in terms of progressing here. You've still got that Strongbow listing coming for South Crofty. Again, more box ticking and attention on Cornish mining. And thirdly, Strategic is a profitable company. Don't underestimate that. And the fact that the board, particularly John and myself, have significant wealth invested in the future.
Marvellous stuff. Peter, good to chat to you. And no doubt we'll be catching up in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.
No doubt. Thanks a lot, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Haydn Locke, Chief Executive Officer of Emerson. That's EML ticker. Haydn, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Justin. Good to be back.
Now, we're going to go into sort of the fertilizer space, potash space, what it's all about, what drives it, interesting points about it. So I know people are not that familiar with it. So, you know, it's a bit of background, really, on your company. And before we do it, that, Haydn, just for people not aware, just explain what Emerson's about, please.
Emerson's listed on the London Stock Exchange, and we own the outstanding Chemisette potash project, which is located in northern Morocco. It's a development stage project. We put out a scoping study last year, which confirmed it's among the lowest capital cost potash projects in the world. And as a result of its location, it's also among the highest margins. So really an unbelievably strong project to be in the hands of a junior, and we're accelerating the development of that project.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to, you know, at the moment, what's the next sort of milestone you're hoping to achieve there?
Well, we put out an announcement, I think about a week ago, mm-hmm. basically saying we kicked off the environmental studies. We've got a team on the ground. That is really about taking that next step towards permitting this project. So the key document that we need in order to permit this project is the ESIA, which we think will be complete sometime around the end of the year. So really one eye on moving this towards a permitting process. But in terms of work on the ground, there's drilling ongoing at the moment. We'll see results from that coming out in the near future. We've done some metallurgical test review programs, and we'll be kicking off the metallurgical test work program in the coming weeks. That'll be finished some point this year. And then we'll kick off the feasibility study, which will deliver loads of news flow over the next sort of 12 months. So lots of work going on the ground.
Yeah. Let's sort of zoom out there and look at the macro sort of trends behind fertilizer. So explain, what is actually happening in the fertilizer space at the moment then, Haydn?
It's pretty interesting because, you know, we saw a lot of change in the commodity cycle and there was sort of a mini bull market in the commodity cycle. And in fact, the same thing happened in the fertilizer space. I guess the key difference is the fertilizer space is still very much in a mini bull market. Mm-hmm. So since the low prices of around mid-2016, we've seen nothing but one-way direction in prices in all of the key fertilizers. So phosphate, potash and ammonia. Most of those markets are up over 30%. In the case of potash, it's up over nearly 40% in some markets. So fairly strong general demand and fairly strong thematics. And that's really confirmed by the largest fertilizer producers in the world. So we're talking the Canadians, Nutrien and Mosaic, who reported their last quarter numbers, and they were frankly very, very strong. I think the biggest story has been really the rebound of demand in Latin America and China. which is in particular in potash, is driving record years of demand in both 2017 and 2018, and now is expected to be another record year of demand in 2019. And then I think the second big growth story is really what's going on in Africa. Mm-hmm. So the world in fertilizer is growing at sort of 2 to 3%, but Africa is growing at nearly 10 times that rate. Now, it's growing from a fairly small base, but that is absolutely massive for the fertilizer industry, and we're seeing a huge focus on that from the big fertilizer producers. And in fact, I was listening into OCP, the big Moroccan fertilizer company's earnings call recently, and they think that they control about 62% of that African fertilizer market. So there's some big movers and shakers going on with focus on those key markets, and we're expecting to see more strength in 2019 and on into 2020.
Yeah, so I mean that's the general theme. I mean, increased demand from, like you say, like you know, there's Africa and there's Latin America and China. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think, you know, talking, you mentioned before the sort of trend and macro theme. The real macro theme in the agri sector is really how we're going to feed this growing population. So the numbers are quite astounding in terms of how many people are coming into the world in the next 30 years. They're estimating it'll be 2.2 billion more mouths to feed in the next 30 years. And I always put that into context by saying that is equivalent to a city the size of London every month and a half for 30 years of more mouths to feed. It's pretty astounding when you put it in those sort of that sort of context. And really, that's what's driving the general long-term thematic.
Yeah.
But in addition to that, we're also seeing things like food security in countries like China, where it's becoming much, much higher on the policy agenda for the Communist Party there. You know, really, how do you keep your population happy? You make sure it's got a full stomach. And so they're really out there looking to try and pick up fertilizer assets in the background. And we've actually seen a number of transactions in 2018 that show that the Chinese see this as a strategic mineral. So they bought a big stake in Arab Potash from Nutrien for about $600 million. They've been acquiring a lot of potash development projects in Africa that are, frankly, have very large capital costs attached to them, but they're still out there looking at them. They're rumoured to be looking at a private potash asset in Brazil at the moment. So there's actually quite a lot going on in the background in this market as people jostle for position to really position themselves for what is a long, long-term cycle.
Yeah, well, you mentioned as you know, anywhere in the world, China's of course becoming the biggest economy. It will be, I don't know when, but they say it's very soon, and the biggest, most mouths to feed. But they've got that, you know, trade tariff war going on there. Has that affected anything in the short term?
It hasn't thus far. Certainly not in the fertilizer space. It has very much so in the agricultural space. Mm-hmm. I guess the biggest impact, the most obvious impact, has been the impact on the trade of soybeans. So the US has traditionally been the largest provider of soybeans to China. They average sort of 4 to 6 million tons of soybean per month. You know, that's mainly to feed the Chinese hog industry or pig industry. But post the trade war, this has dropped off significantly. And actually, I think in November of 2018, China consumed no US soybeans for the first time since 1977. Wow. Now, what's really interesting about that is the biggest beneficiary has been the Brazilian market. So the Chinese exports of soybeans from the Brazilian market in the last 6 months have gone up 80%. And that, for a country like Brazil, which is primarily driven by agriculture, that is a huge boon. That's a very big win for the Brazilian farmers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what we'll see is, you know, Brazilian farmers planting a lot more of these cash crops with a focus on China. And as a result, we would expect to see, you know, the record-breaking run of fertilizer demand from the Brazilian market to continue in strength as China looks to diversify away from the US in terms of its exposure to the US agricultural market and any craziness from Donald Trump.
Yeah. Well, that's not going to stop happening. So you mentioned there you were on a conference call, one of the biggest producers there. So what's happening? How have they been performing? Because it's always worth looking at the bigger guys.
Yeah, they've been performing really well, actually. So Mosaic and Nutrien, the two Canadian producers, reported extremely strong results in the last quarter. So for Nutrien, the largest fertilizer producer in the world, their EBITDA was up 30%, which for you know, for any large industrial company is an absolutely massive number to increase in, you know, quarter on quarter. So very, very strong. What was really interesting from those calls were they're expecting the strength to continue very much into 2019. And in fact, you know, we're still seeing, if you look at the demand for the various fertilizers in their key markets, in a, you know, year on year, the same month, we're seeing really strong growth versus January 2018 to January 2019. So they're all pretty bullish at the moment, and we expect to see further good results from those big companies in the near future.
Yeah. We're talking about China, going back to China there. They sort of recently relaxed its tariffs on the export of sulfate of potash. I mean, is that going to have an impact, or what do you expect to see in the broader fertilizer market as a result of that?
Yeah, that was a big surprise, actually. I think it caught everyone off guard. China is one of the largest, well, is largest producer of SOP, about half of the world's production, and historically have not had any exports of SOP as a result of these tariffs. We expect to see some impact on the SOP price. You know, basically, you're suddenly allowing half of the world's production to then go out into the market. But realistically, I think SOP is very much a niche commodity in the fertilizer space. So we're not expecting to see a huge amount of huge impact on the rest of the fertilizer space as a result of this relaxing of export tariffs. So you know, it's one of those where it probably affects SOP more than it affects the rest of the rest of the market.
Yeah. And you mentioned that China have been buying assets. Can you see that continuing? Is that going to keep happening?
Yeah, absolutely. I think China, you know, especially with the food security, China have placed basically all fertilizer assets on the strategic minerals list in China. So really what that means is that they would prefer to exploit somebody else's resources before their own. And it's really part of that 100-year view in China. They take a much longer time horizon than the West. And so as a result, they're thinking very strategically about how they best manage their finite resources in country. So we've seen a lot of things going on with Chinese companies. You know, I mentioned SDIC buying that stake in Arab Potash for about $600 million. There was a recently announced partnership between China and Sonatrach, which is an Algerian oil and gas company, but have a huge phosphate project in Algeria. So that's a $6 billion investment from the Chinese to basically diversify their supplies of phosphate away from those where they're most exposed. And then, of course, you've got you know, SQM's, the lithium stake in SQM, which was acquired. Now, although that is headline a lithium transaction, there is a lot of movement going on in the background and partnerships going on in the background that are focused on SQM's manufacture of a number of key fertilizers, but in particular nitrate of potash, so potassium nitrate, which is a very high value fertilizer. And so, yeah, we're seeing a lot of quiet, I guess, stake building by the Chinese in the background, which is very interesting and really we expect to keep playing out.
Yeah, yeah. In this country, I'm assuming here that you know, most people don't have a broad knowledge on fertilizer companies. But I suppose the one that's most well known amongst the private investor community is Sirius Minerals, and they're valued at about £1 billion. So where are they at? What are they all about at the moment?
Yeah, so Sirius has done an amazing job in educating the market, you know, on that agri theme, and you know, they've spent quite a lot of time doing it. So they're in the middle of construction at the moment, got their first phase of financing away, raised I think about $1 billion, and now currently waiting for the second phase, but they're well into production. I mean, they recently announced that they changed the structure of the financing arrangement on the phase two financing, mm-hmm. which is, it's an interesting announcement because it suggests that the banks are still not quite comfortable with the overall risk of the project. And you know, whether that's sales and marketing risk or is it execution risk is the big question. It was probably a disappointing result for the management of Sirius that the government couldn't get its act together and get them that UK government guarantee. But I think it's pretty likely that they're going to get that high yield portion of the debt done, which will certainly keep the project marching forward towards its you know, initial production at some point in the next couple of years. So it's an exciting project for the industry, and be very interested to see how it plays out, especially given that they're bringing a new project to market, you know, to compete with the incumbents.
Yeah, yeah. So everyone's sort of heading towards, you know, green and clean and all that stuff, and rightly so. But is that reflected in the sort of fertilizer market? Are people going sort of non-chemical now and organic as well? Or what's happening?
Yeah, there's a big push away from what we call the chemical fertilizers. And so this is where Sirius's marketing angle really is focused. So the nitrogen-based fertilizers especially, we're seeing, you know, people are looking for ways to reduce their consumption of that. You know, that's really focused on trying to mitigate, I guess, environmental damage, especially in places like China. But we're also seeing it in places like Brazil. So there's a company called Harvest Minerals. It's got a direct application natural fertilizer.
Yeah. You
know, really, these natural fertilizers tend to be lower grade. And as a result, location relative to end market is absolutely fundamental to being successful, which is why Harvest Minerals looks like an interesting project. But I think, unfortunately, there's no really truly affordable substitutes to the incumbent fertilizers. So we're going to see a continuous usage of what we've always used, which is, you know, I guess the nitrogen-based, potash-based and phosphate-based fertilizers. And we'll continue to see very solid demand growth for the traditional fertilizers.
Yeah, okay. Well, as always, Aidan, one final thing here. If someone's listening to this, likes the sound of what you're doing, but are not following the story, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add you to their watch list, please.
Fertilizer is in an incredibly strong place at the moment. We're expecting a record year of demand for potash in 2019, set off against tightening supply, so expect strong fundamentals in the market. At Emerson, we're developing one of the lowest capital cost potash projects in the world, and as a result of its location, one of the highest margin projects, so outstanding project fundamentals. And we're incredibly well funded to deliver on our milestones and news flow over the next 12 months to deliver that news flow for shareholders.
Marvellous. Hayden, good to chat to you. And like I said, lots going on, so no doubt we'll be chatting again in the not too distant future. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Paul Griffiths, Chief Executive Officer of Predator Oil and Gas. PRD is the ticker there. Paul, thanks for joining me.
Hi, Justin. Good to see you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, listen, you've got a lot going on at the moment. Very busy. Some news out over the weekend on Friday, and we'll delve into that in a bit. Before we do, Paul, as always, people tune in for the first time now and never heard of the company before. Could you just summarise what Predator Oil and Gas is all about, please?
Yeah, we have three projects now with the addition of Morocco. Initially, we started in Trinidad looking for early production from CO2 EOR, and that's going well. And we have licenses next to the Corrib gas field and the Kinsale gas field in Ireland. And that's proceeding with the approvals for the next successor authorizations. And then Friday, we added Morocco to the portfolio.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, take us through that. So on Friday, you announced the issue of a convertible loan note to raise $1.5 million for the Moroccan license award. So take us into that, take us what's all about, and also why you use that particular, because I know sometimes convertible loan notes strikes fear in the hearts of many, but explain that, please, if you could.
Well, that was considered to be the best financing option. The money's going to be used to put up a refundable bank guarantee to the Moroccan government for securing the Gercif license. And because we wanted to advance the signing ceremony as quickly as possible and put the bank guarantee in place, because we have a lot of interest in the license already from potential partners, we needed to move very quickly. And the convertible loan was a mechanism for moving quickly. Mm-hmm. For us, it's attractive because the funds are immediately available for putting up the bank guarantee and securing the license. And secondly, we have 45 days before the lender can even begin to convert. Mm-hmm. And the news flow in the next 45 days, we hope, will be substantial with progress on Trinidad, Ireland potentially as well. And of course, Morocco, the signing ceremony and investigating drilling partners. So all in all, it was a quick mechanism in the current climate to move to secure the license, which we see as one of the most valuable things in the company. Mm. And that was the reason for doing it. So, you know, as the largest shareholder in the company, I'm not overly concerned about the convertible loan. I have more to lose than anybody else from any inappropriate form of financing for the company. So I'm very happy with this relationship as the largest shareholder.
Yeah, yeah. Just take us through what you know about this Moroccan license and the potential here.
Well, it fits our strategy. I mean, we've always said we're focused on gas, and also we're focused on being responsible in trying to reduce CO2 emissions, which gas does relative to oil. Morocco generates about 80% of its thermally generated electricity from coal. So there's a great demand to drive for gas production and gas developments in Morocco. And this is reflected in the fact that the gas prices paid for the next 5 years for the Rahab Basin operator, for example, will be $10.5 per MCF. Now, that might not mean too much to your audience, but that's 72% higher than current UK gas prices today. So it emphasizes the fact that Morocco wants to push for gas and wants to push for gas to power. It's low taxation, just a 5% royalty. There's virtually no other country in the world with a similar opportunity with that sort of taxation rate. And the government and the state oil company are 100% behind the operators in developing gas, which is unusual for Western and Europe and in parts of North Africa. So it's very encouraging to have the government standing there supportive of this project side by side.
Yeah,
I also should point out that EBRD, European Bank of Reconstruction, and Enagas, the large Spanish gas utility, have invested heavily in Morocco in infrastructure. And I think you should note also that EBRD announced publicly about a week ago in Morocco that they're no longer mandated to invest in oil, only gas, as it's seen as a way of reducing CO2 emissions. So for all those factors, non-geological, that's why we're in Morocco.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's hopefully the next milestone here you hope to achieve?
The next milestone is we want to advance drilling this year in Q4, obviously with the potential of a number of companies already looking at hopefully partnering up with us. It gives us the opportunity to drill Q4, at some point in Q4. That's entirely achievable. The wells are simple to drill. They're very uncomplicated. It's a dry gas play, which is very cheap to develop. It's 9 kilometers from the infrastructure, the Pamagreb gas pipeline. And obviously, there's a very high success rate for this kind of play in the Rahab Basin, which most people know is where STX operate. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I'd point out is that the size of prospect here is something that's never been tested for this proven play in Morocco before. So that's why it's significantly material. It could be in the order of 100 times more in size than the average sort of 1 to 2 BCF discoveries in the Rahab Basin. And we know that the Rahab Basin is very profitable for the operator and creates lots of free cash. So from that point of view, you know, geologically as well, it's a really exciting prospect.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned that it's news flow happening, and of course, there's things going on at Trinidad there. And so let's deal with that first before Ireland. But how are things happening in Trinidad?
In Trinidad, we're waiting on the approval from Heritage, who are formerly called Petrotrin. We hope to get that before the end of February. Everything is all set up to start operations there, but we can't obviously start without the approval. In Ireland, we're still waiting for the grant of the two successor authorizations, and we hope that that's imminent. We have big plans for Ireland going forward, but obviously it's dependent on getting these successor authorizations in the next month or so.
Yeah.
And then in Morocco, obviously, we plan, as I said, to drill this year. So in terms of news flow, I think we've got plenty of active news flow with the addition of Morocco. And let's not forget that we're in a really big hotspot for gas activity in Morocco, northern Morocco. One of the operators in Rahab Basin is planning up to 12 wells. And, of course, you have Tendrara, which will be additional drilling activity. So we're kind of in the center of that, which will be good news flow.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm assuming you're very happy and pleased with the way things are developing there at Predator?
We're very happy. Sometimes it can be frustrating for shareholders because progress is not as fast as they like. But we have to remember, in this day and age, approvals take time. We live in a very different environment to 5 or 10 years ago, so we have to go through our various processes that are largely out of our control. All these things will happen. They will happen in time, but we can't control the time frame. Whereas in Morocco, it's a slightly different situation, which is why we pushed Morocco hard, is that the government and not even the state oil company are partners with you, and therefore the approval process is simpler, more efficient, again, very wary of the environment and also CO2 emissions, but everybody is aligned on the same page to get things done quickly. And this was one of our main reasons for adding Morocco to the portfolio, in order to speed up our activity and diversify our assets to ensure that we always have one asset progressing at some point in time.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Paul, one final thing to do, or three final things to do. If someone's listening right now, looks at the sound of what you're about, but are not yet following the story, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add you to their watch list, please.
Well, Morocco's game-changing addition to the portfolio. It fits our focus on focusing on gas and reducing CO2 emissions. In terms of news flow, as I said, Morocco is a hot spot. The northern Morocco for gas exploration is the center of activity. Lots of drilling activity going on. Third point is that obviously accelerating drilling activity from our point of view is beneficial to the company, as we see this prospect as being a game changer for the company. And also, I just mentioned that our management were instrumental in the catalyst for the Tendrara investment. So we know Morocco well, we know these opportunities well, and we're very, very, very excited by this one. And we are, as a board, not going to give it away.
Excellent stuff, Paul. Good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll be catching up in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Malky, oil and gas sector specialist. You all right, fella?
Yeah, very well, thanks, Justin. Yourself?
Yeah, not too bad. Busy Monday morning. Yeah. Lots of news out, it seems like. So let's crack through, Malky. What are you looking at?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's plenty of news out, and the oil price is having a very, very decent rally indeed, I must admit. It's working roughly the way I thought it would, but Brent is now 66.50 nearly, which is a long way off the bottom and having a good run. A combination of things for the oil prices. Saudi Arabia have cut back by well more than their production quota, and they've got a bit of a small problem on one of their biggest fields. They have nice fields, Justin. They have fields that produce 1 million barrels a day.
Wow.
Which is nice work if you can get it.
Yeah.
And so there's a bit of less production coming from Saudi, which is helping. There is a feeling in the marketplace that there's a deal to be done between the US and China on tariffs, which could push American crude, which they're obviously net exporters of now, in towards China, which wouldn't surprise me at all. So, you know, it's all positive stuff. And we've got, as you say, a bunch of announcements in the last few days that people will be interested in. And starting today with Sound Energy, who, you know, sort of Lazarus-like people thought a couple of weeks before Christmas that the shares, it was all over. But they were drilling the second of the three well program in Tendrara in onshore Morocco. And they've announced, they made several announcements about this well because they did find gas, and it now it's a confirmed officially as a gas discovery, which is, as they say, unlocking the Tendrara Basin, which a lot of people thought would happen back in sort of T5 and 6 and so on. But this is a material upgrade of the net pay. There's a lot of work to be done on this well still to come, to be fair. But it is does make the Tendrara area potentially multi TCF potential. Mm-hmm. And so they've announced that at the top of the range. Net pay is up 47% to 15.4 metres and a low of only 9.5 metres. They're going to have to mechanically stimulate or frack this well, because some of the pay will be accessed through distribution in the rocks. Mm-hmm. But they've got gas reserves now estimated at 1430 BCF, with a high of 3408 and a low of 584. I think that the numbers, you know, the shares have gone up a bit, which is probably appropriate. And you know, Tendrara is, it's obviously, they know that they've got the Tajri gas in the region. It's quite difficult to find and get out. So they've done a pretty good job here, I would say.
Yeah, God, look at that share price. It's shot up in, say, July 2016 from 10 pence almost a quid. And then it's been slowly grinding lower for a couple of years and recently just fell off that cliff, like you say, where everyone was a bit worried there was nothing was going to happen here. But it has bounced a bit from like 10 pence up to 25 pence. But, yeah, that's a rocky old chart, isn't it?
Yeah. That's out and out oil exploration, oil and gas exploration for you,
yeah,
mate.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, what's next, Malky?
We'll go through one of the announcements last week. We had more announcements from Genel Energy last week, and things are going pretty well there. More reserves upgrades in Torquay, as that's the big field in Kurdistan. Despite a good year's production, they've increased the numbers at Torquay, that's T-A-W-K-E. And they've also got a field called Taq-Taq, which is T-A-Q. And they've announced last week that that Taq-Taq is doing remarkably well. A little while ago, people would have thought that Taq-Taq might have been just drilling out here. But they've had one or two very successful wells on the flank of the field, and these wells are beginning to form very well indeed. So, you know, I interviewed Bill Higgs, the COO, last week, and when I talked to him about that, it's the performance from the flanks of the Taq-Taq field are very impressive indeed, and they might even think about 21,000 barrels a day from this field in 2 or 3 years' time. So, you know, just good news all round from Genel, where we've I mentioned it last week. The Peshkabir was the absolute star of the show last year. They'll still be drilling some wells on that this year. It's within the Torquay field, so they'll be drilling there. And of course, as I mentioned last week, they've got huge potential development in a thing called Bina Bawi. Historically, people thought Bina Bawi would be a very big gas development. Then they found some oil on the top. And I think that they are now in the process of getting together with the ministry, the KRG, putting together a deal whereby there will be a big gas development, but it'll be done in stages, and it won't be an absolute monster to start with, and it'll be, you know, able to be paid for by doing the oil as well. So all things going very well at Genel Energy.
Yeah, G-E-N-L there to get
correct.
With it. And what's
that's
else?
Right. Next one is Rock Rose Energy. I mean, this is a star of the show in itself.
Yeah.
I don't know whether you've ever interviewed Andrew Austin, but...
No, I've seen it being mentioned quite a few times on social media. A lot of people getting into it. It's chucking out a bit of cash, isn't it? Or it's undervalued compared to what
really
it's selling for.
This was a business which they decided to do the extended purchase of production. A lot of people like, you know, a lot of exploration companies, Justin, like to do exploration, but actually it's a more efficient way to do it, is to have production as well to offset against.
Yeah.
Andrew Austin with Rock Rose went into the process of buying production. He's done extremely well. He announced last week, the reason I was going to mention was that there's a huge increase in the reserve base the Ross and Blake fields have been extended by 5 years. And these are the advantages of buying something, especially if you buy them relatively cheaply. You find that the recoverable reserves are either bigger than you expected or will last longer.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, the reserves are up 9.4 million barrels on a 1p basis, and they've actually increased quite substantially by 4 million barrels just for this field. So basically, they buy them, they upgrade the fields, they bring them on production, they've got them in all sorts of different states. They've got one coming up next year. They don't have any worries about decommissioning costs anymore, because that's all been officially catered for. They've got more problems with what they're going to do with the cash, to be honest. They did quite a substantial share buyback last year, and I think they're going to either have to have another buyback or bigger payments to shareholders or both. And Rockrose is in a very strong position.
Yeah, I know. Like I said, it is getting a lot of attention on social media there. A lot of people buying it up. RRE is ticker there.
That's right.
Cool.
A couple more quickly to mention. President Energy, I've mentioned a couple of times. They had their reserve report out last week, and that showed that the concentration on the Rio Negro fields in Argentina has been very wise. That was an acquisition they made a little while ago. They've had their 1P reserves up 82%. Their 2P reserves are up 41%. That was significantly helped by a three-well program at the end of last year, which came in very nicely. Production now 3,300 barrels a day. But also they're increasing their gas production, which is very helpful, partly for the fact that it fuels all their fields in the area. But they're now selling gas and power into the electricity grid. So they've got the two acquisitions, Las Bases and Puerto Prado, which they made and completed at the end of last year. So everything looking with a decent program of workovers and recompletions and proper wells towards the middle of the year, I guess. Very positive for President Energy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm always getting confused. It's PPC. I always think it's PPE, but it's not. It's PPC.
PPC there, mate. And I met up with Eco Atlantic Oil & Gas last week. I think you've interviewed Gil Holtzman a number of times. And obviously the excitement that is being developed at Eco is very substantial. I met up with them the day after Tullo had their announcement for their update and their drilling plans for this year. And the excitement only got bigger when the head man at Tullo said that the most exciting thing they were going to be drilling this year would be their Guyana prospect, which is they share with Eco Atlantic. Two, probably three wells in this country, where Exxon have just announced two more big discoveries to go along with the dozen, whatever it is, they've already announced. I think Eco Atlantic is still significantly undervalued, actually. You are taking a risk on a well, but in the area, it appears to be in quite a strong position. I would be advising people who wanted to put a bit of beta into their portfolios that Eco, and you'll find out in the middle of the year as well. And of course, they've got a modest position in the block, so they could, if there's a discovery, they could become a big company themselves or sell out to Tullo or maybe Total, or anybody else who wanted to be in a, what is a very, very hot postcode in oil and gas at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. ECO Guild's been on the podcast several times. Yeah. Anything else, Martin?
Two quick ones. I noticed that iGas, it was a gas leak in the Sun. The Sun doesn't often have big oil and gas features, but they leaked out that iGas, who are drilling Springs Road at the moment onshore in the UK, had found preliminary. Their previous well was called Tinker Lane, it looked like a very encouraging initial discovery. Needs lots of testing, and at Springs Road, where they're drilling at the moment, I understand that they've encountered the Boland Shale. It really is interesting with what's been happening onshore recently with Quadrilla you know, there's no doubt that the quadrilla discovery is actually very substantial if they can get to grips with it. Obviously, we know that that INEOS have got some exciting prospects. You know, it's quite possible that we, you know, if given, you know, properly looked after in the circumstances of the drilling and everything else, that there's a lot of parts of this country that could be powered by our own gas if we actually let it happen.
Yeah.
And finally, I thought I'd better mention Anglo-African Oil and Gas. We mentioned them before, and I know you've spoken to them a couple of times.
Well, hopefully coming on, hopefully very soon.
Well, the share price is stubbornly below the previous raise, even having had a discovery. I think the point is worth making here. I'm not going to rain on anybody's parade, because it is no doubt that it's a discovery, and they have potentially three areas where they can, formations where they can produce from. On the way back up with the well that they've got at the moment, they are going to produce from the Mingo and the R2 intervals, which we've talked about before. But I reckon that the market is worrying that they haven't got enough cash to do that. Yeah, they've said today in an announcement that they've got, they said last week in an announcement they've got enough cash to be able to pay for the production, and once they get the money in, they'll be able to do those two intervals. And they've also got the much deeper Jane discovery, which will need to be assessed by a much bigger and better rig, which they will need money for. But if they say that they're going to get income from the first and second formations, then we'll see how it goes. The market isn't convinced that they'll be able to do that, but we'll have to see how much they produce in the meantime. Mm-hmm. And they've just announced today, which I'm sure they're going to talk to you about, is that they have a situation whereby the local state company still owes them quite a lot of money. SNPC is the Congolese national oil company. They owe them $10 million. Anglo-African have spoken to the government and said, actually, now that they've had a discovery on it, we'd rather take a bigger stake in the field and not have the $10 million. Well, today they've announced that they've been given $1 million, or just under. Well, actually, I think it's more like $700,000. Of course, it's good either way, because they're either going to get all their money back, or they're going to get an increase in the field. I think that looks like they're going to have the sort of slightly worse of the two options. They're going to get the money back, which means they'll spend the rest of their lives trying to get money out of SNPC. But if they had a bigger stake in the field and they could get a bit of money and a bigger stake in the field, they'd be doing well. So, the market are being quite cautious about Anglo-African at the moment, but they have had a discovery, and you've got to give them credit for that.
Absolutely. It'd be nice. I mean, I've got to speak to, I haven't spoken to David Seffen for a while, but hopefully he's coming on either today or tomorrow, so we'll have a catch up there. But it seems for some reason the market isn't liking what's happening at the moment. I don't know why. There we are. Malky, thank you for that, fella, and we'll catch up next week.
Yep, look forward to it, Justin.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at 5, 88 Energy. At 4, Red Emperor Resources. At 3, Foot Asylum. At 2, Motif Bio. And number one most followed company is Europa Oil and Gas. It's UOG ticker there, of course. All right, top five most liked RNSs are as follows. At 5, Ascent Resources, AST. At 4, 88 Energy, Operations Update. At 3, Sound Energy, that's T10, Net Pay Upgrade and Volume Estimates. Of course, Malky covered those in the podcast. At 2, Anglo-African Oil and Gas, S&P Costs Reimbursement. And number 1, most liked RNS, came from UK Oil and Gas, Portland Oil Production Resumes at Horse Hill. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos appreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.